Welcome to Rings of Power Reactions. I'm Aaron, your host and fellow Middle-earth wanderer. Here you'll find reviews, reactions, and deep dives into the lore behind Amazon Prime's Rings of Power. To go deeper, come wander with me on my main podcast, Lore of the Rings. Visit ringspodcast.com or find Lore of the Rings on your favorite podcast player. Now, let's wander Rings of Power. Welcome, wanderer, to Lore of the Rings. I'm Aaron, your host, and today I have a real treat for you. My guest is Marilyn R. Pukala, academic, author, and prolific podcaster. My introduction to her was through her podcast called Rings and Rituals. There, she seeks to uncover what the various rituals can reveal about the different cultures portrayed in the Amazon Prime show Rings of Power. If you love today's episode, be sure to leave a review and share with a friend. Now, let's wander. Marilyn, thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today.
Well, thank you so much, Aaron. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's start with your own journey into Middle-earth. How were you first introduced to the world and works of J.R.R. Tolkien?
Sure. So it was around age of 12, some 55 or more years ago now. My very dearest friend and heart sister, Karen, we had met and bonded very quickly in a sort of a C.S. Lewis kind of a way of, what, you like that too? But not over Tolkien. It was over the original Star Trek.
Okay.
When it was actually showing live on TV once a week with new episodes each week kind of thing. So we're talking history here. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, you've never heard of Lord of the Rings, you have to read this book. And of course she was right. So it was fairly early on when I read that. And then, like so many other people, I was in 1977 on the edge of my seat for the Silmarillion to come out. So we finally had more Middle Earth. And I sat down, I opened the book and I read it and I thought, where am I? What is going on?
Where are the hobbits?
What is this thing? But the line that caught me was, and ever after, the children of Iluvatar would listen to the sound of running water and know not for what they listened. Hmm. And I completely identified with that. And I said, okay, I can do this.
Yeah,
I can make my way through this because it's speaking to me. So Tolkien became a part of my life and all the way through college and grad school and so forth. My first library job, my first professional job after my degree, I was allowed to audit classes, and there was a class that someone offered in the English department on Tolkien sources. And so I took that and was very much enamored of it. And so when my next job came along and they said that I could actually teach courses and not just audit them, I said, yeah, I think I'd like to teach a course on Tolkien sources.
Oh, wow.
And so I did that off and on for my 35-year career at Colby College. And then I retired in 2019. And we all know what happened in 2020, 6 months later. And that led me to first discover podcasts. Mm. And soon led me to the Prancing Pony podcast, where they happened to send out a call for research assistants. And I thought, well, let's see. I'm a research librarian. I've taught a course on Tolkien. They might be interested in me. And so I was delighted to spend a couple years, doing research for Alan Sistow and Sean. And that then led me to be very confident about sending an email to Lorehounds when they asked listeners, if anyone knows what a Barovian is, please write in.
Hmm. Wow.
Now, can you imagine me not responding to that request? Which I did, and things just kind of blossomed from there. But it was watching the responses to the Harfoots by people in these two communities, the Lorehounds and the Prancing Pony podcast. Mm-hmm. And hearing comments like social Darwinism and so on, particularly around this harvest ritual that they did. And I said, I've got to explain this. I've got to tell people what this is about. I guess maybe it's time for me to do a podcast. And so that's how Rings and Rituals came about.
I love that. I love that story. I can't imagine what it was like coming back a little bit to 1977 and feeling like, I've read The Hobbit, I've read The Lord of the Rings, I'm ready for the Silmarillion. I guess I go back to when I was waiting for Harry Potter.
Absolutely.
Waiting for that to come out. It is an apt analogy, but at the same time, the scale is incredibly different. Like waiting for Silmarillion versus Harry Potter, not even the same universe really, but a similar feeling I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're right, the Harfoots, complicated, a complicated culture, and misunderstood in many ways, and either loved or hated upon, and not much in between. And so I'm really glad that you decided that you were inspired by their harvest ritual to feel like you had something to teach, something to share, some insight that you can impart to the fandom. And I've been listening to Rings and Rituals, and I will say it has given me some new insight into Rings of Power, some new appreciation for it.
Oh,
for
I'm
sure.
So glad. I'm so glad. The other courses that I taught were on Religion of Contemporary Witchcraft and Women in Myth and Fairy Tale, and on Harry Potter. I did religious mm-hmm. responses to Harry Potter and so forth. So I knew what a Samhain ritual was. I knew about rituals where you honor your beloved dead. And this is precisely what they were doing. I also knew that as a migratory culture, they weren't going to have cemeteries. They weren't right. going to have the possibility of cremation or any of the kinds of things that we take for granted now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as a small migratory culture, they really had to place the good of the group before the good of the individual. And that's something that in our individualistic day is not terribly popular. So I see where it came from.
Yeah.
But I also saw the misunderstanding. And that was what led me to say, okay, let's look at ritual and see what the showrunners want us to understand about mm-hmm. these cultures that they are developing from the bones and the small hints that we get about Second Age cultures from Tolkien himself.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. So let's dive a little bit deeper into Rings of Power.
Mm-hmm.
As of the time that we're recording this, this is post season one. So we've seen all 8 episodes of season one. We are weeks away from season 2 coming out. We've seen mm-hmm. some teasers and some trailers, etc. But help us understand a little bit of where you're coming from. How do you feel about the adaptation choices so far in Rings of Power season 1?
Well, the big sticking point for me, as it is with so many people, is the whole Mithril origin story.
Yeah.
I think of all, I had what I called my 3 egregious lore breaks. This one is just really the most challenging to just sit back and swallow. I was really hoping that when Círdan arrives, he would say, "For the love of Manwë, don't you people know anything about your own origin and your constitution and, you know, the fact that your Fëa do not die?"
Right.
But I heard that. Something recently that I'll just say that I'm afraid that that's not going to happen. I think they're just going to let it lie as is, and which in a sense, you know, that means that we can all have our own headcanons and say, okay, well, this is what really happened, but they just didn't decide to film that part of it, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I found the compression of distances difficult and confusing at times. Knowing what I know about the geography of Middle-earth and how important it was, you know, the fact that Galadriel and Halbrand could, you know, ride for 7 days from, in essence, Mordor and arrive in Eregion. I mean, you know, you kind of have to, okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And overlook it, particularly with a gut wound. But of course, that's another story altogether.
Yeah, that was one thing that really frustrated me as well. It's like, okay, well, we have like 3 entire novels or 6 novels. We have the entire Lord of the Rings in which we're going from Rivendell to Mordor, and we're just going to like basically go backwards to that with a wound in, you know, within 5 minutes of screen time. It was a little jarring for me.
Yeah. When you're seeing these vast landscapes and so forth, you do have this sense of breadth and largeness and so forth. Mm-hmm. And a choice like that just... I understand. I mean, they were kind of conflicted because obviously the kind of gut wound they were showing us, you know, the wonder is that the man survived for a week, never mind survived for a week on horseback without stopping.
Right.
But it was still broke the suspension of disbelief kind mm-hmm. of approach to things. Yeah.
Yep.
And one of the biggest challenges for anybody who is wanting to put this in any kind of visual medium, to my mind, is not humanizing the elves too much. Yes. Which is almost impossible because, of course, you have a human audience. You want them to relate to your characters. Therefore, there has to be some sort of quote-unquote human characteristics and qualities to them. And I think they run into some trouble because of that. You know, I know a lot of people are not happy with Galadriel's character. I happen to love Galadriel's character. I mean, you know, she developed into the woman we see in the Third Age over the course of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So why should we think that she was always like that from the get-go? Doesn't make a lot of sense. I found Gil Galad, for example, to be, you know, pretty political. Elrond is probably the most elvish of all. Well, actually, the real most elvish of all is Elrondir.
Right.
Who is a completely made-up character, and that's really fascinating. But because they want character arcs, you know, this perpetual insistence upon we must have character arcs. How do you have a character arc when your character lives for 3,000 years? I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of challenging. And I noticed it.
It is a little bit tough. And there were a couple other lines, if I'm remembering right, about humanizing the elves. I think Celebrimbor tells Elrond at some point that the dwarves sculpt the rock as if they were caring for an aged parent. And I just kind of thought, that frame of reference doesn't really make sense for an elf.
No,
sure,
it really
they
doesn't.
Get older, but it's not like our parents getting older and we have to, you know, take care of them. And there's just a kind of a few other things. I guess the very beginning where Finrod is talking with Galadriel and he's like, I'm not always going to be here to explain it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he first said that and I was like, what? You're not? You know?
Just like young Galadriel did.
Yeah, and then she reacted the same way. And she's like, wait, you're not? You know, and so it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, they kind of picked up on that, but still it was that, as you say, it kind of broke me out of the enchantment of the story.
Mm-hmm.
and made me remember that I was, you know, in this fictitious world. And so there's a couple things there where, yeah, they definitely did humanize the elves a little bit. But Arondir, I mean, yeah, fascinating character, different culture of elves, different style of elf.
Exactly.
And I think there's some good potential there.
Yeah, I have to say that the young elven children kind of threw me out, too. They just weren't beautiful. I'm sorry. They were good actors, but they just didn't look all that elvish to me.
Yeah, you didn't have the beauty of Elvendom and then
all
that bullying in Paradise.
Well, I
don't know.
In my head canon, the bully was a young Kurufurin. So.
Okay, all right, okay. if we want to explain it that way, that's fine. We'll do that.
So I love so many of the new characters. I mean, we've talked about Elrondir, but Disa, oh my gosh, what an extraordinary character. Bronwyn was actually my favorite from the time I first saw the posters. Because you remember the torso posters?
Right.
I saw the sickle. I saw the almost regal sort of clothing that she had. And I thought, okay, agricultural, probably herbalist, maybe healer. Seems to have some kind of leadership position. I mean, they really conveyed her character through that image to me quite well. And all the Harfoots, you know, I think the Harfoots are probably one of the greatest unexpected successes. And I never understood why people said, well, we're not supposed to have hobbits in the Second Age. Well, did you think they sprung up from under the mushrooms in the Third Age? You know,
they just sprung up out of the grass.
Right. How long does it take? They are humans.
Right.
How long does it take, you know, for that particular divergence on the branch of evolution to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, some form of hobbit had to be around at this point. I love the visual recreation of the Second Age. Oh my gosh, Numenor. It's like I could stare at each frame for half an hour.
Yes, and I actually did for some time. I would just pause and be like, wow, I just want to like mentally walk through those streets.
Yes. And the more you look, the more you see. I was so thrilled to hear Ramsay Avery describe that shrine to Nienna.
Mm.
Because it had caught my eye, and I thought, oh, that looks like Ishtar. That's an interesting statue. What's going on with that? And when he said, I said, oh, of course. You know, Mediterranean Nienna, descent and return, grief,
right.
Loss. It was fantastic. I loved it. And I really can't think of a single scene or costume or prop or countryside that felt out of place to me or jarring or totally unexpected. It just, all of those choices were wonderful. Of course, they had John Howe, which was definitely
right.
A help.
Yes. Yeah, helping
and
with
the music.
Visual component.
Oh, Barry McCurry's music. Just spectacular. Wonderful. I will admit to being somewhat doubtful when I heard there was yes. going to be this shift. I didn't know him at all. I don't play video games or you know, online RPGs or whatever, so I never heard any of his writing before. But I hear him growing as a musician in this project, which is really exciting to me. I mean, I'm somebody who loved opera at the age of 12. You know, my first opera was Parsifal, so Wagner. So the whole concept of leitmotif is something I'm very, very familiar with. And I am a violinist. I can't play anymore because of tendonitis, but I have that classical music background. And so I was thinking, well, okay, it sounds a little, you know, not classical, let's just say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the first tracks that came out, they were the excerpts. So you could hear the major themes. And I thought, well, all right, that's nice, but it's ABA. It's over. Then you hear the score and you hear what he does with these things. And you're like, wow, okay. Yeah. This man knows his stuff. And it's spectacular.
What you're saying really resonates with me. And I'm not classically trained or technically trained on classical music. I do enjoy listening to it. And I've picked up a couple of things over the years, but a very similar experience. When I first heard some of the first tracks, I was like, well, it's not Howard Shore, but you know, it seems decent. But then listening to it in the episodes and then listening to the soundtrack afterwards, and it blows me away. It really blows me away. I remember one day I was so touched by the themes and the lyrics of This Wandering Day that I just played it on repeat.
Wow.
And I just had to write my feelings that it was coming up, you know, because it was just so touching and moving to me. I just repeat, 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 repeat. And it's I find that particularly beautiful. So yeah, at first, a little hesitant about the music, but really blown away by that. And when people ask me what I think about Rings of Power, that's the first thing I say is amazing music.
Yeah.
Beautiful music. So that was season one of Rings of Power. Some things to love and some things that maybe we don't love so much. What are your hopes for season two? And again, just to remind the listener, season two is about to come out in just a couple of weeks as of this recording. So all we've seen are some teasers and some trailers. Marilyn, what are your hopes for season two of Rings of Power?
Well, my first one was the debunking of the mithril origin story, but I've already heard something that leads me to believe that I have to toss that one out.
So okay.
I'm hoping that Círdan will bring some gravitas and some good sense to Gil-galad. I'm really, really excited to see Círdan finally realized on the screen and having a storyline. He's a much beloved character and much overlooked as
well. Very overlooked and very behind the scenes. You know, here he is. He's almost like the eldest of the elves in Middle-earth. He's, you know, some of the oldest. He's so old that he can actually have a beard.
Right.
When elves get so old, they can have a beard.
And I love how they've treated that in the images that we've seen of him. I think it's absolutely perfect. It's not down to his belt line yet, right?
Yeah, but exactly.
It's great.
It's not a dwarven beard. It's a beard in an old elvish style, right? So,
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to Círdan, you know, and he's there at the beginning and he's there at the end, you know, with Galadriel and Frodo and all those folks finally do leave Middle-earth. Círdan is there. So he's a bit of a background, but crucial character.
And he's even there after that point, because of course he has to be there for Sam. And I mean, they're a little vague about exactly when the last boat sailed, you know.
This is true. Yes.
Who was on it? Where did it sail from? And so forth.
Yeah.
There is some thought that Círdan was actually one of the original 144 that woke up at Quemion, which is the origin story of elves, for those who haven't read that part of the Silmarillion. And I can hold on to that. And his utter obedience to the Valar, who he has wanted to see all his life but hasn't, first for the sake of the person we eventually know as Thingol, who you know, was led astray in the woods and stood there for 100 years staring into the eyes of Melian the Maia. That was the first time that he missed the floating island. And then subsequently, he started to learn to build ships that could get across the Great Sea. And when he finally had one, when it was all set to go, he receives this direct and unquestionable communication from the Valar saying, wait, we need you to be there to be of service to all the other people who will eventually be sailing. And he said, I obey.
That's amazing.
Just extraordinary.
Wow. Yeah, that's a beautiful thought. I did not know that. Or I had not actually come across that tale yet of Círdan. And as you share that, it sparks in my mind that he is like the exact antithesis of Sauron, right?
Yes.
Here's Círdan, who has this deepest desire of his heart, and yet is willing to put that aside for the betterment and help and sacrifice for others, right?
Yes.
In obedience to some higher power that he feels knows better than he, like, but complete opposite to Sauron, who, this is the desire of my heart. I want to dominate everything. I want everything under my control, and I'm going to literally destroy the world in order to get what I want. It's like complete opposite.
Yeah, it really is. Those bits about Círdan come, many of them, from the histories of Middle Earth.
Okay.
And so if you have an index volume, which I happen to have, it's real easy to go to the back of the book and say, okay, Círdan, and just look at all the different references, because most of the characters, he changed over time, but there's some incredibly moving material there about him.
Parents, here's a gift idea that doesn't require batteries, screens, or endless assembly on Christmas morning. It's called the Dadventures Deck, a deck of silly adventures and unexpected twists for you and your kids. Pull one card and suddenly you're on a superhero bike ride or turning the backyard into a treasure island. My daughter still talks about the memories we've made from this deck. I've only got about 20 of these decks left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you want a simple way to spark memories with your kids this holiday season, go to ringspodcast.com/deck. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/deck. Start making more epic memories with your children today. Okay, so Círdan's coming for season two. What else about season two are you hoping for?
I'm looking for Isildur to mature.
Hmm.
I'm ready for him to not have to do the whole angsty late teenage, I don't know what I want to do with my life thing. I mean, he looks a little old to be doing that now, but I also think it's not unreasonable given his mother's death by drowning.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to be in the Sea Guard where you're having to shout the sea is always right at least three times a day. I mean, that had to be
jarring.
Really hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the tension that they've hinted at in season one within the family of his brother Anarion having gone west, because that's where the quote-unquote real Numenor is, as Isildur tells Galadriel in season one, where they're on the ship on their way to Middle-earth. And it looks like we're going to get some good stuff along those lines. It looks like from the teasers and trailers and so forth, spoiler, that he and Arondir are going to team up together, and I want to watch that unfold. I think that's going to be good. I hope there's not too much gore, but, you know, that's what eyelids are for. I hope they're going to continue developing an interesting storyline for the Stranger. And again, from the things we've hearing, spoiler, you know, meeting up with Tom Bombadil, which is, I didn't actually list this, but this is another thing I'm really beginning to look forward to even more, is how are they going to realize this character who no one has ever had the ability or the courage or the whatever you want to do this.
Gumption.
Yeah, that's a good word. So it's nice that the two of them are going to be coming together. Really looking forward to seeing Hrun. I mean, this is something no one has ever seen outside their own imaginations or headcanon, or presumably it's represented in some of the video games as well. I want to have the return of Celeborn.
Ah, yes.
And the resulting new arc for Galadriel. I would love to see them going off together after the Battle of Regan, traveling through Khazad-dûm, as they are described as doing in one of the, I think that's an Unfinished Tales,
yeah.
And then arriving in what will become Lórien, and her starting to, she's been so outward focused, so action for so long. I hope she gets to settle into some contemplation now.
Yeah.
And, you know, really work with this ring, figure out what it is, how it operates, how she wants to use it. Because the showrunners have given themselves lots of leeway. They've been kind of vague about the functions and the properties and all this other stuff. And they've kind of shifted over time as to exactly what these rings are supposed to do. And, you know, so maybe we can, you know, get this studied. Besides, we've got to get Celeborn in here eventually.
Yep.
No child brides here, please.
She's got to show up somewhere. You bring up so many really interesting points, especially Galadriel. Could Celeborn and the reuniting of that relationship, I mean, in season one, it reveals that she's operating under the assumption that he's dead, that he's KIA in battle. Will we see that reveal here in season two? Maybe, maybe not. And I think your assumption of if that does happen, that might lead to a more contemplative, reflective moment for Galadriel. I would really love to see that in her story arc because, I do love the rough and tumble Galadriel. Very ambitious, very, she's got the commander mindset, right? I mean, you read the Silmarillion and you can see that. But what we also get in the Third Age of Middle-earth, as soon as the Fellowship shows up, we see a Galadriel who is still powerful, but is sort of playing, I call it psychological warfare between her and Sauron, right? Like, Sauron is trying to find her with his mind, with his will. He's extending out that power, and she's evading, and she's piercing his thought. And she's misdirecting, she's doing that whole like psychological campaign against Sauron. And I would love to see the development of Commander Galadriel to Lady Galadriel that is not necessarily using her sword, right? Elrond says, put down your sword, and she's like, What am I to be?
Exactly. Well,
we know what you're to be. You're to be psychological ops Galadriel, right? Professor X. Maybe that's a little bit derogatory, but I would love to see that character arc start for Galadriel.
Well, part of that too, I think, could manifest in what's called Osanwe, which is in effect mind-to-mind communication. And that was one of the reasons in the texts why Galadriel was not deceived by Sauron. That was something else that I kind of regretted from the first season. You could make a case for her ring extending her abilities of Osanwe, because my reading of The Lord of the Rings is that she's blocking Sauron.
Mm-hmm.
She is able to, and not just of her own mind, but of her people, of her land, of her location, all of those sorts of things. And so it could be that Narya, her ring, could serve as an enhancement for that in some fashion.
Right.
But it takes a lot of time and focus, I think, to do that. So
and practice, yep.
And practice. Yep. She's going to get plenty of chances to practice. May I talk about one little moment in the trailer? Do you mind if I bring that up?
Or yeah, please go ahead.
There's one image where we see Elrond reaching out his hand while he's talking to Galadriel in the what we hear, the vocals. And then there's another shot of Galadriel standing there with a hand reaching and touching her face.
Mm.
I think that's two completely different scenes. And I got this idea from Matt of Nerd of the Rings, and I think he's absolutely right. I hope that hand touching her cheek is Celeborn.
Right.
And this is the moment. And not Elrond. I mean, I wouldn't mind if he did, but it felt all wrong for how their relationship has been drawn up to this point.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful. That's what I'm pinning my hopes on.
So those are your hopes. Mm. Let's go to the other side. What concerns or fears do you have regarding season two?
Well, the first thing is I really hope that people will not spend a lot of time comparing Rings of Power to Shogun or to House of the Dragon.
Hmm. Okay.
Which will be hard because it's following hard on the heels of those two shows.
Mm-hmm.
Both of which had excellence in their different ways. One can have preferences and so on. But I can tell that there is excellence in both of them. I just hope that people will allow that to be those shows and look at this show on its own terms. Again, that was sort of one of the roots of Rings and Rituals. Wanting to look at the show and its characters and what we were presented on its own terms. What were the showrunners wanting to show us and tell us? What kind of story were they wanting to bring us? Rather than the constant comparison, which I do too, Tolkien lore, taught it for all those years. But it still is an amazing achievement, and I want to be able to appreciate it on its own terms without any kind of comparisons and measures and markers and things. Doesn't mean I won't be, critical when I feel criticism is warranted. Let's let it be its own thing and not let the other seasons from this summer run it over.
Yeah, I love what you're saying there. And I'll admit, I'm the first. I've oscillated in my feelings towards Rings of Power. And so I've tried to really take Rings of Power on its own merits. And they're still like, I still struggle, I think, to bifurcate sometimes. Rings of Power as a show and what I have read and understand about Tolkien.
Yeah.
And where those don't match, it's like, well, either I don't understand something or the showrunners don't understand something, or maybe we're all coming to a different conclusion altogether. And so I just kudos to you to be able to say, let's watch this show on its own merits as an adaptation and not necessarily as Tolkien lore. So
from all the things that I've heard from all the people who have been to events and talked to the showrunners and heard the showrunners talk about it, they know their lore. They really do. In fact, they may even know some things that I don't know. That wouldn't be surprising because, you know, we all see things differently. We all have access to different texts at different times, and mm-hmm. we layer them over and we come up with our own conclusions. So if I think of this as the showrunners doing the incredibly brave task of letting their headcanon be exposed for all the world to see.
And criticized.
And criticized for it. I mean, it's a little bit like what Tolkien said when he sent the manuscript off to be published for The Lord of the Rings. He said, I feel like I've exposed my heart to be shot at.
Yeah.
So I want to respect the creativity that went into this. If they didn't use the lore points that I would have used, well, they have reasons, and maybe I should at least find out what those are.
Mm-hmm.
I can still disagree with them. I will never accept the mithril the tree. I mean, you know, that's just,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's just it. But they had their reasons, and you know, maybe they will prove to have worked, and maybe they won't. We'll see. The other thing I keep trying to remember is we've only seen 1/5 of the total.
Yes, it's true. 20%.
I don't want to be judged on 20% of my output. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I want to see the whole thing before I, you know, really get deeply into, well, this was a success or this was a failure.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair assessment. To let things play out a little bit and maybe recognize, okay, things are a little bit different than decisions I would have made, but maybe we can still mm-hmm. take mm-hmm. this for what it is and appreciate it for what it is.
And of course, if you can't stand it, then don't watch it. You know, don't yeah. suffer through
anything.
No
one's forcing you to watch this.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can always retreat back to the beloved books and, mm-hmm. you know, settle in with that. Reconstruct your own imagery and canon and all the rest
yes.
of it.
Yep.
And I will also say that many of the things that people were saying about this show, I was saying about the Peter Jackson films back in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Because they break canon too, my friends.
They do. Mm-hmm.
They yeah. really do. And I think a lot of this current generation, their foundation of Middle Earth is the Peter Jackson vision, even if they have read the books, because image that you see is going to stick in your memory far longer than the printed word or the text or hearing somebody read it aloud. Our amygdala is our memory, and that is associated with vision, but it's also associated with emotion, and images raise emotions, and so that's just going to get fixed in there.
I definitely come from that generation. I think I had been exposed to the books before the films, but I was the target market, you know,
yeah.
young teenage, young man, mm-hmm. target market for those films, and it totally brought me in, and I have to check myself and remember, Aragorn was not the reluctant king. He was carrying around his broken sword, and there were some film adaptation choices made, and I think eventually we'll be able to come to terms with that. Other fears for season two?
Well, it seems all but confirmed now that the stranger will be Gandalf and not a blue wizard, which I find disappointing.
Yeah.
And you had this huge sandbox to play in, quite
right.
literally, in the case of Rune.
Yes.
Why not take these few hints about blue wizards? You could create an entire new understanding of wizards and what they were. You
yes.
could. There's so many directions they could have gone. I wish cut the ties with Peter Jackson and start doing their own lore appropriate creations, you know, putting their own spin on things. Because otherwise, why are you working with this period in the lore that is so nebulous and vague and that does give you so many possibilities
yeah.
for advancement? Now, okay, first season, you wanted to pull people in. I get that. So you want them to feel at home. You want them to feel, yes, this is quote unquote my Middle Earth. I recognize it. But every time I heard a Peter Jackson line, I was thrown out of the story. I was no longer in Payne and McKay's Middle Earth. I was back in Peter Jackson's Middle Earth. Well,
mm-hmm.
I know that. I can go watch that.
Right.
Tell me what your vision is. Let me see that. Let me see a new facet through your eyes. So I hope they're going to do more on that. And we do have to recognize that there are certain beats that we must move towards and achieve by the end of our series, because everybody knows what happens, you know, at the Battle of the Last Alliance and at Mount Doom and so forth. So, okay.
Yeah.
But between that beat and the beat of Elrendil sailing to Valinor and the destruction of Beleriand and so forth, thousands of years to play in. Yes. All kinds of imaginative possibilities. I just hope they don't try to do too much. I know they're going to spend at least two episodes on the battle at Eregion. Someone, I think, said they were going to spend three episodes on this battle.
That's
and I'm like, okay, so how much more are we going to have to, you know, quickly cram into in order to move all the plot points along far enough?
You bring that up, and that was kind of one of my criticisms of season one, was I feel like just the pacing was just really off, that there were just a lot of filler episodes where nothing, the story didn't really move forward very much. But then all of a sudden, in the last 10 minutes of this whole season, we're going to build the Rings of Power, which is like, that's like the critical function of, that's the title, for crying out loud. Like,
yeah,
you'd think it would take at least two episodes to think about that, but I don't know. I've never created a TV show, but so I don't know. Take my opinion for what it's worth, but the pacing and trying to do too much definitely resonates with me quite a bit.
Well, I think a lot of people felt that way, and some listeners may be shocked to learn that in the lore, it took over 100 years from the time they first decided to make rings to the time that they actually started to make some.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sort of a jaw-dropping response to how it all happened in the end.
And Gandalf hints, you know, in his conversation with Frodo in A Shadow of the Past in the Fellowship of the Ring, he hints that there was a number of like lesser rings, like essays in the craft, right?
Before
they really came into their own, and they're like, okay, now we really know what we're doing when we're crafting these rings and we're imbibing them with powers. And it was just like, oh, we're going from nothing to the three most powerful rings besides Sauron's One Ring. It was a little bit of a head jerking reaction there.
Yeah, and I'm a little uncomfortable with the shadow of danger that they're putting over the three elven rings. I think the amount of involvement that they showed Halbrand having with their forging was appropriate. Because in the end, they said, well, we're not going to do it the way he said, we're going to do it this way. And he was not there at all. The sort of backdoor keyhole, whatever the analogy is in coding, to let Sauron in, I think they are making more visible by calling it the thing that helps, you know, give power not over flesh but of the flesh.
Right.
Or of the flesh but over flesh, excuse me, I got it backwards. So okay, there's the Sauron stealth code that's that's gonna be a problematic thing once he makes his own ring. Making them out of order, you know, that's kind of jarring. It just seems like they're making them a lot more like the One Ring than they ever were. Not just the three elven rings, but, you know, the dwarf rings as well. And each one being a separate project. And I mean, now I'm getting down into the weeds of details that lovers of lore can go on and on about.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, we go deeper. But,
yes,
but
that's not fair to the story, really, at the end. They had their reasons for doing it this way. Maybe we'll see them. Maybe we won't. But remind myself to sit back and let them tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's so many characters that we've seen from season one, and likely some new characters in season two.
Lots of them.
We've touched on quite a few of these already, but maybe one or two. What are some of the characters, maybe one or two that we haven't touched on yet, that you are really interested in digging deeper into their stories?
Well, alas, Bronwyn, we won't be seeing much arc from her.
Yeah.
I regret to say. Galadriel, of course. You know, she's been made almost the viewpoint character in a way. I'm really glad how Elrond looks from what we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really looking for him to start coming into his own and, you know, growing the maturity. And, you know, we've seen him so respectful to his elders. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But still kind of serving as Gil-galad's voice.
Right.
Writing his speeches and, you know, being his representative. I like just the way they've changed his hair. Suddenly I'm like, okay, I can see that this Elrond has matured, and that one shot of him looking haggard from the effects of warfare. I think canon-wise, this is the first war that he has actually participated in. I mean, the show is implicated that they've had this peace that's going on for hundreds of years, and this is why Galadriel is getting up Gil-galad's nose, because she keeps charging around saying, no, but Sauron isn't dead yet, and that's not the approach he wants to take. But there is a sense that really there are no battles being fought during this period that Elrond would have been able to participate in, but that is going to change.
Yeah.
Disa, wow. What a rich character. I haven't talked about her yet, but my gosh. I love so many of the things that they're doing with her. I love the actor's voice and how they are letting her use it to its full power and extent. It's just that we see her alone doing the singing to the stones. And in this next season, there's going to be three of them, herself and two others. So I can't wait for that. And they're setting up a lot of character conflicts for her. I mean, people were saying she was beginning to look a little like Lady Macbeth towards the end of the first season. I don't see that in her in the bits that they've shown us. You know, now maybe they're just showing the Disa behind the scenes when she's saying, you know, Doran, I'm frightened. But there's one scene of her with an axe and Narvi with some other tool, and the two of them standing together, and yeah, they're ready. They are ready. But how does she deal with the increasing rift between her husband and his father?
Yeah.
And what you owe a king to whom you've given your oath when that king seems to be going mad. It gets very Shakespearean. I haven't heard too many people use that adjective for this, but I wonder to some degree if that isn't what they're going for.
Yeah.
Particularly with King Durin.
I can see that for sure.
And then Adar, fascinating character. I'm perfectly adjusted to the, or I think I feel like I'm perfectly adjusted to the change in actor, although I was very sorry to lose Joseph Mull.
Yes.
The scene between him and Galadriel, probably if I was hogtied and forced to pick one scene from the whole season one, I would probably point to that one as being the most dramatic, the most impactful, and the most insightful, and the most revealing of character. Both Galadriel's, but also Adar's. I've heard some stuff about how that first scene is going to unfold, and I really can't wait to see it. And then finally, Ents! Ents! And Entwives! Entwives!
Yes, the Entwives! Yes!
Finally! Yeah. Finally, they took that step. And again, so many possibilities for how they might work out. I've always assumed that the Grove of the Entwives was where the Harfoots would go.
Yes.
And, you know, the Grove that we did see in the first season, I don't think that was supposed to be the Entwise Grove. I think there's yet another grove further down their path where they're heading. And imagine bringing together Ents and Harfoots and Tom Bombadil.
Oh, yeah. Right? What a sweet combination.
What a mix.
Yeah. Yeah, the Entwives. That's one that I am actually really excited for, to see Entwives. And I remember watching the trailer where the Entwives are introduced and they're actually having a conversation. I was like, oh, cool, Ents. And the Ents are talking. And it like went over my head. And it wasn't until the second time I watched the trailer and I was like, hold the phone. That's not just an Ent. That's an Entwife. Like, what? And then my mind was like, just totally blown. And I'm totally looking for, because that, for me, I remember reading as a kid. As a kid, I remember reading Treebeard explaining, you know, we've lost the Entwives. We don't know where they are. You know, they wanted to do this. We wanted to do that. And I was so sad. I was so sad. I was like, where are the Entwives? Where are they? Right? And to this day, still as an adult, I mean, I haven't done a whole lot of reading about where the actual Entwives are, but I am really actually very excited to see Entwives portrayed in season two.
Yes, and I love the visual realization because it instantly reminded me of Treebeard's confusion when, I don't remember if it was Pippin or Merry asked him, well, do they look like you? And he was, no. And that's what that felt like to me.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, it's an ant, but wow, it's a really different, you know.
It's a different kind of an ant, yeah.
But their eyes are the same. That was his thing. And I think these eyes also looked the same. Yeah. And she's got apple blossom. So I just think that in my mind, that's what that is. Yep. So I just think that's cool.
If it's looking forward to that one. So you have a recent project going on, a podcast called Rings and Rituals. Which I've been listening to. The episodes have been really great, inspiring for me, helping me see things in a different light. For you, what has been one of the most surprising insights that you've discovered as you've gone through that project?
Well, let me say first of all that I am not alone in this project, that I have a wonderful and dear colleague, Dr. Sarah Brown. It has been excellent to work with her and to have the two of us, you know, kind of bouncing off each other and just really really enjoying that together. I don't know that this counts as an insight necessarily, but...
Parents, here's a gift idea that doesn't require batteries, screens, or endless assembly on Christmas morning. It's called the Dadventures Deck, a deck of silly adventures and unexpected twists for you and your kids. Pull one card and suddenly you're on a superhero bike ride or turning the backyard into a treasure island. My daughter still talks about the memories we've made from this deck. I've only got about 20 of these decks left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you want a simple way to spark memories with your kids this holiday season, go to ringspodcast.com/deck. Again, that's ringspodcast.com/deck. Start making more epic memories with your children today.
I guess I'm tooting my own horn here, but what surprised and delighted me so much was the number of people who were saying that we've allowed them to go back and do a rewatch and feel less hot under the collar about it all. And that's extraordinary to me. I will not say that that was a goal when I first started. As we went along and then people started to say this, I thought, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
I'm really glad, because that's the kind of thing that I would love to encourage. I mean, as a professor in my time, I wanted to encourage students to look at things with a new perspective. And somehow we managed to do that. So hooray us.
Yeah, I think you're doing an excellent job on that. And I'll be the first to raise my hand and admit and be like, there are some things in Rings of Power that I was really hot and bothered about. And, you know, I'd go look for other folks and see, well, maybe I'm the crazy one here. And, you know, they were kind of giving kind of the same sort of thinking that I was. And I was like, okay, I guess we're the ones right. We're the right ones. And then I started listening to a little bit of your different perspectives and looking at it from a ritualistic perspective and trying to judge the show on its own merits. And it opened up some new insights and pathways for me where I was like, oh, okay, maybe this wasn't exactly the way that I knee-jerk reacted to it, and then found other people who reacted the same way. And I can find some new insights there. So I'll definitely raise my hand and say, yeah, you've helped me see some new things for sure.
Well, please understand, I was also hot and bothered about a lot of stuff too. Please hear that, listeners, because it was absolutely true.
Yeah.
But I remembered being exactly the same way with the Peter Jackson films. And I knew that over time, I grew to love the Jackson films. There are still certain places that I will, you know, I will just fast forward through them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't care to see Frodo telling Sam to go away and Sam going.
Right.
Again, yeah. Egregious number one, followed closely by Faramir and Aragorn. Anyway, different series. So I figured, okay, if that's true with the Peter Jackson, it could well be true for this too. And again, as I said, it was the Harfoots. I really felt like I needed to explain the Harfoots as I had experienced them, because I thought it was wonderful. I thought they were great. Of all of the new creations and new characters and so forth, they're creating this whole culture, but they're doing it in such a way that it can lead to a culture that we know and love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, okay, this is because I have this particular knowledge. Not everybody has it. And I don't mean to sound, you know, high and mighty about it all, but, you know, how many people know what Samhain is, right?
Not many.
No, no. By the way, it's a pagan festival. At the fall of the year, it comes from Celtic tradition, and it offers a chance to honor the beloved dead and to recognize the end of the year. And that's basically what they're doing. I have no idea if Payne and McKay were thinking of this when they did it. But they sure landed it, whether or not that's what they were thinking of. So for me, the most surprising personal insight, orcs have rituals in this adaptation. I cannot picture the Peter Jackson orcs having rituals. I mean, my mind won't stretch that far.
Right.
Maybe they do, but he certainly didn't spend any time showing us that. This show showed us orcs having rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of them were fairly familiar, you know, the ginning the troops up before battle and, you know, shouting death as you're marching on your foes and so forth. But that scene with the dying orc and Adar coming, and they form two lines and they bow to him and grunt respectfully as
respectful as a grunt can get.
Yeah, exactly, as the subtitles tell us.
Yeah.
And it's funny, through the whole first viewing of the season, I just didn't think twice about it. But because I was looking for ritual, I started seeing it. And my own previous assumptions would not have looked for rituals and orcs, but I don't know what else to call it. know, it was clearly there. And I wonder if that isn't in part because of the fact that these are earlier orcs, that these are orcs developed, well, Adar himself clearly being of Elvish origin, and him breaking with Sauron and, you know, trying to establish as far as he could with whatever alterations had been done to him, this own culture with its own place where it can be themselves and live and maybe even develop more rituals. Who knows?
Right.
But that was the thing that really had me a bit gobsmacked.
Yeah, and it's interesting you call that out because, you know, we're all familiar with Peter Jackson's orcs that are great on screen. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to forget that Tolkien wrote orcs and goblins who sang songs.
Well, that's a good point.
Right? Can you imagine an orc in Peter Jackson, like, singing a song, you know, rip, crack, snack, you know, whatever. I can't even remember what it is. But the orcs would sing. And singing in unison requires some level of cultural identity. I don't know if it is quite in the realm of a ritual, but there is some sense of otherness that we usually don't get on the on-screen portrayals of orcs and goblins and evil creatures, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure how Tolkien would have felt about the notion that orcs had rituals. I hadn't really thought about it before. I'll have to go away and contemplate that for a while. I think it might have distressed him somewhat, but he eventually wound up being distressed anyway, as people were pointing out that he had basically created a people whose only purpose was to be killed. He got caught in that tension of only Eru Iluvatar, you know, the overarching all-father deity, could create. Mm-hmm. Everything else was a sub-creation.
Yes.
Including his own story, which he saw as a sub-creation. And so what was he saying, that orcs were twisted elves? Does that mean that they have serial longevity too? Are they responsible for their moral choices?
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end of his life, again, this comes from Histories of Middle-earth, he started saying, well, actually, no, orcs come from humans. And part of that, I think, was having lived a long life and seen horrific things on the part of humans.
Yes.
He often referred to humans as orcs in his letters to Christopher when Christopher was with the RAF during the Second World War, and saying things like, we have orcs on both sides of this conflict.
On both sides,
so
exactly.
It just came more and more to him that, you know, they are reflecting this very ugly side of humanity and human nature. So what does that mean? What's the implication? He did not wish to create a group that had no access to redemption, no irredeemable anything, because everything was good to begin with.
Right.
So he was really in quite a bind, and he's kind of created this whole notion in other fantasy literature that followed in his footsteps, that you got to have some, you know, massive numbers of enemies, and you can charge in screaming with your sword and slaughter them all, and this is quote unquote a good thing.
It's tough. It's a complicated tension, to be sure.
I was also reminded, because I think I already knew it, but it was definitely a reminder of how much our own cultural expectations will affect our understanding of other cultural rituals.
Okay.
And I've already talked about that a little bit with the Harfoots. I'm also thinking, to shift universes again, I'm thinking of the Acolyte.
And Star Wars.
The recent Star Wars, where at the heart of that whole story and conflict was a misunderstanding of each other's cultures. And that would be a fun tangent to go on. I'll have to think about that. And then finally, doing this work reminded me of the scholar Carol P. Crist. Very early on in her career, she wrote, symbol systems cannot merely be erased. They must be replaced. And I'm thinking of this in the context of the Numenoreans.
Okay.
Visually, they represent to us a culture across a large span of time, which has moved away from its ritual origins, if you will. Its quote-unquote, well, its spiritual origins. Their origins were, they knew, you know, Manwë and Uldmo and Uinen and all these beings were factual.
Right.
They were real and true, but they were also factual in their world. But over time, they've turned away from that. But the symbols are still there. Mm-hmm. We see the statues. We see, and this is a wonderful visual metaphor, the statue of Uinen with her long flowing hair and her gestures, you know, looking very, very watery. is in the jail cells that Numenor has converted from former living quarters for Numenoreans who wanted to sort of do a monkish kind of a thing, only it wasn't really that, but wanted to study deeply, you know, the truth of these beings in their world and so forth. And there was Uadin to watch over them in their studies in the same way that she watches over the ships as they sail. Well, we're clearly moving away from that now, but we got to have something else. And what we get is the sea is always right. Now, I've never liked absolutes. And so the sea is always right. Yeah, I wasn't comfortable with that from the first time I heard it. And clearly it sticks in the craw of Isildur and probably Elendil too, although he's not really talking about it too much. But there is this sense of massive power that deserves respect, which I can trace a line from that back to recognizing and respecting and thanking Uinen. And that's why we have this, the ritual of the branch of returning. They haven't let that go yet. That's still there. They can't bear to let go of that particular symbol because they still emotionally rely upon it. And I can just picture sailors saying, oh, well, we know it doesn't really mean anything more, but, you know, we'll just put it on
tradition.
There anyway.
Yeah.
It's tradition, why not? And one listener pointed out to us that sailors can be notoriously superstitious.
Right.
So what was a symbol of a spiritual connection could have been turned into, you know, this sort of superstitious, you know, toss salt over your shoulder and scare away the knock on wood, all of those kinds of things that we have now that have these other origins. That kind of grounded it for me in a context of an academic system of looking at ritual from an academic perspective. And both Sara and I are academics, but I don't think we ever really brought, you know, theory and that praxis and that kind of thing into it very much. But it was there. It was there in our minds and our experience as we were, you know, looking at all these things through a particular lens, which, of course, is a very academical kind of thing to do anyway. So there you are.
Fantastic. Well, Marilyn, I think I could continue this conversation for a long, long, long time. If one of my listeners wanted to reach out or find a little bit more about you and your work, where should they go?
I have a digital commons page where if you search my name, it will pop up sooner or later. And it has a lot of downloadable papers that I've written. And some of them are on Tolkien itself. I'm not on socials. I'm on Facebook, so you could probably find me there. Mostly I'm on the Discord channels for the Prancing Pony podcast and for the Lorehounds. So if people want to, you know, approach me through that venue, that would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That Discord channel for Lorehounds, I've been on there and interacted a few times, and you've got a great audience, great fan base over there. So certainly if any of my fellow Middle-earth wanderers who are listening to this, if you want to go check out the Lorehounds Discord, I highly recommend it. Great place to be, great people. I mean, you could interact with people like Marilyn and ask all sorts of questions that you didn't even know there was an answer to, but Marilyn has an answer. She's got the answer.
The librarian creed is, I don't know all the answers, but I know where to look them up. So I'll take that.
That's fantastic.
I don't know all the answers, but I can help you find them.
Well, if Tolkien's the professor, then we need the librarian of Middle Earth, and I'm going to turn to Marilyn for that. So,
well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Aaron. It's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.